This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith with three key stories from three hosts. In the USA, I'll talk to John D. Steinbrunner about a new report to the CIA on disruptive climate change. Radio EcoShock Washington correspondent Jerry Williams talks with Jonathan Kaufman of Earth Rights International. Why do big oil companies pay for spills in developed countries and get away with murder in Nigeria? Then radio host Daphne Washam reports on the fantastic growth of renewable energy in Germany. She's in Berlin with expert Hans Verholm. A new report to the CIA advises them to prepare for disruption in a warming world. The title of the assessment from the National Research Council is Climate and Social Stress, Implications for Security Analysis. In a strange irony, presentation of this report to the CIA was temporarily postponed as the capital closed down due to a violent storm, Hurricane Sandy. Our guest is John D. Steinbrunner. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland and chairs the 14-member panel of experts who conducted the analysis for the intelligence community. Dr. Steinbrunner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Who is the intended audience for this report?
It's the U.S. government as a whole, basically. What we're trying to say is that the issue of global warming is extremely serious, and it promises to have severe disruptive effects in countries we care about, and that it is important for the government to begin monitoring both climate variables and social variables much more systematically than they're currently doing to anticipate trouble before it fully ripens.
Well, can you give us an example of a climate security threat that may have already occurred?
I can give you an example of one that is in chronic infection mode, and we mentioned that in the report, and that is Pakistan, which is clearly an internally fragile society, and is being subjected to very severe pressure due to reduced flows in the Indus River Valley, which moderately complicated story, but it has to do with the dynamics of glacier melt in the Karakoram glaciers in the Himalayas. That is subjecting the reduced flows in the river, suggesting Pakistan to severe internal pressures because they rely on hydroelectric power generation in large parts of the country, and they also rely on water for irrigation purposes, and they're really favoring irrigation over power generation. As a result, they're getting daily or weekly, even daily riots in Pakistani villages about power outages. And there is also internal tension associated with the allocation rules for irrigation favoring the Punjab over the Sindh. Sindh is a much more arid province. And so we see the Pakistan government under increasingly severe pressure and basically not handling it all that well. And that's the type of situation we need to worry about.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Pakistan. I've been thinking about that because in the floods of 2010, which covered an estimated one-fifth of the land area, and it's a nuclear-armed country, there could have been more social breakdown, but my understanding from people who were there was that the government looked after its own supporters first and may have been strengthened by disruption in areas where they had weak control anyway. So, and another example of that same thing is U.S. hurricanes. We could say the poor response of the Bush administration weakened the federal government, while Obama's team response may have strengthened at least public perception of the necessity of a strong central government. So these events might play either way, making a government stronger or weaker. What's your thoughts on that?
We're making that point, exactly that. The net consequence of a severe climate event has a lot to do with the social reaction broadly defined. That's the coping capacity of the people immediately affected and the government's response, the responsible government's response to it. Yes, an effective response can actually strengthen governments. Part of our point is, however, is that there is good reason to expect events that are a good bit more severe than anything yet on record. And we can hope that all the government responses are going to be equitable and effective, but the chances are that some of them won't be, and we need to get prepared for the consequences of that latter situation.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, about the Al-Qaeda-type radical fundamentalists that have lately established themselves in the African Sahel nations and where drought is just ravaging that area. Does climate change open the door for terrorism?
There's a distinct possibility that it does, yes. And Sub-Saharan Africa is, we know, to be one of the places we need to most worry about. in terms of both of conflict dynamics and climate dynamics, yes, that there is a distinct possibility that chronic pressures of this sort will create conditions that inspire not only terrorism, but sort of local civil conflict, strong enough that it requires international response. The difficulty here is that we know beyond reasonable doubt that the consequences are going to be very large. But we do not know, unfortunately, the timing, magnitude, location, all the particulars with sufficient precision to make confident predictions. And so what we're saying is you have to look for trouble. You have to expect it to occur. Trouble of a magnitude we haven't encountered yet before, so something beyond recent experience or any experience. We need to monitor more carefully to pick it up earlier so that we don't sort of get too surprised and that we're prepared. It's a very abstract argument, sort of going outside the bounds of experience and saying there's reason to do that, but, it's difficult, I imagine, for people to, it's an abstraction and it's difficult for them to absorb.
Well, yes, indeed. The National Research Council talks about, quote, climate surprises in the decades to come. And I can see things like that. We could have frozen methane on the sea floor. The clathrates could suddenly melt. We might have a burst of warming we didn't look for. Would you elaborate on this idea of climate surprises?
We were looking at adaptation issues rather than mitigation. When you're talking about sort of the release of frozen methane on the seafloor, that is, we put in the category of a tipping event, sort of passing a threshold where suddenly you get a feedback process that really makes the whole situation globally a lot more dangerous. We looked hard at that, and we had to admit that there's no scientific basis for projecting such an event within the next decade. Our time frame was within a decade. So what we did is said, however, we do know enough to say that we should expect adaptation difficulties in some places over the course of a decade, and then with increasing frequency and severity thereafter. And adaptation is more a localized effect, a climate effect that is focused in a particular area, even though there may be global consequences to it. And it, again, carries the affected societies outside the bounds of their coping capability. So that's a narrower view than the more global view of potentially globally catastrophic tipping effects.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about the American intelligence community and their need to prepare for extreme climate events as a national security problem. Professor John D. Steinbrunner is also director of the Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland. John, other military analysts have long suggested the next major war may be triggered over water shortages and water access. You did talk about Pakistan. Does global warming make that threat more serious?
Global warming certainly is affecting water dynamics, and these have very big consequences for societies. That said, it's not easy to fight over water. It's very difficult to nearly impossible to seize control of a watershed and then thereafter allocate water inequitably within the watershed. That is way outside the bounds of what is considered permissible. And even though you might imagine it, nobody's really going to be able to do that. That said, however, the interaction of water issues can exacerbate tensions that already exist, particularly, for example, between India and Pakistan over water flows in the Indus River. Pakistan government actually blames India for the reduced flow in the river, even though the evidence suggests that it is a climate change phenomenon. So it is playing into a relationship that is already tense. It is difficult to imagine how that situation alone is going to generate a war because, again, you cannot seize control of a watershed effectively. Nobody has the capacity to do that. And therefore, sort of in the end of the day, if you have water allocation issues, it really forces even the most severe opponents to some form of accommodation. But that said, it can really induce serious tension in relationships that are already tense and have triggering effects if it's not the prime cause.
Well, Dr. Steinbrunner, before releasing the report, your group presented it to the CIA. Did you get some interest, and is there any way to judge how seriously the CIA or even, say, Homeland Security take climate disruption?
But let me say that the target of the report was not just the CIA, it was the entire intelligence community and indeed the entire government. But yes, I would say that those parts of the government that are involved in security issues are very attentive. I mean, it's not difficult to get their attention. They understand that this potential issue is very serious. Naturally enough, they want specificity. They need to know, okay, what specifically might happen, what kind of problems do. And it's, of course, difficult to give them specificity based upon what we really know at the moment. So basically what we're saying to them is the government as a whole needs to do more refined, more careful, more systematic monitoring of this unfolding story. And if you do that, you will have, with better evidence, we will be able to inform you better. It's an interaction between what we know and what we can measure.
And what role could the intelligence community play in that? How can they adapt?
Well, the intelligence community obviously has major assets for gathering data. And part of what we're saying is combine yourself, align with the scientific community to work out what data we most need to gather and how we ought to use it. Put yourself and the rest of the government in a better position to understand the story as it unfolds. And, you know, part of the message is you cannot do this only by yourself with your traditional secretive methods. Okay, this is a global problem, a global story. It's going to require globally vetted, globally authorized arrangements, and we need to start doing that.
Right, because, you know, I worry whether the intelligence agencies, even if they see something coming for a particular government, would they share it with other government agencies and the public? As we learned from 9/11, critical information can become compartmentalized. And right now, governments in some countries are either publicly denying climate change or trying to avoid talking about it. If their intelligence agencies see a real threat, would the public even find out in time to protect themselves?
Yeah, that is a real issue. I mean, and this is, I think, really a fundamental problem maybe with American culture as a whole. We have problems sharing. There's something about American child-rearing practices that are a little defective in that regard. And what we're trying to say is you've got to share information here, not only within the government, but with globally, okay? If you want to set up a monitoring system, everybody is going to have to contribute to it and get benefit from it, which means that we have to agree on what it is we're monitoring and why we're doing it and how we do it and all that. And access is going to have to be equitable. You cannot just restrict it to any national intelligence agency. You know, just being a little specific for a moment, the U.S., of course, is very interested in precipitation in South Asia. It's one of the things we know we need to monitor. We do this with satellites, okay, but we don't get enough precision with that without ground station monitoring data, which neither India or Pakistan will give to us. India wants to sell it, which violates our sense of how this should work, and Pakistan classifies the information. So we've got a lot of discussing to go to set up an arrangement where everybody agrees to provide detailed data and gets commensurate benefits from the aggregate system. There's a lot of talk and institutional organization in front of us to set up an arrangement of that sort, and we're telling the intelligence communities that's the way you've got to think about it, not in your normal secretive way, but in an open, globally vetted way.
Well, on a more personal level, John Steinbruner, you blogged about a book by Fred Gutterill, the executive director of Scientific American. It's called Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It. I'm wondering, did the NRC or have you thought about the possibility that runaway climate change could bring about human extinction?
It's a possibility we cannot exclude, that's what I would say. We are adding CO2 to the atmosphere at a rate that exceeds anything we've seen in the entire 65 million year paleoclimate record. We've never added at this rate, ever. And that means that we're providing a thermal impulse that will have to be balanced in some way at an unprecedented rate. And that says we're looking at big events here, the possibility of big events. So you cannot preclude that the consequences are large enough to put, you know, the viability of the species in question. Nobody believes that's a short-term question. If that proved to be a short-term question, we would all be stunned and astounded. But it is a long-term question, and we're not yet prepared to cope with it. So the warning is well taken. The last part of the book, how to keep it from happening, there's not much in the book about that. And it's not his fault. It's that there's not much to say as yet about that. We don't yet know or have not yet organized what we need to do to preclude this possibility. And but we're trying to say, basically, this is a very big deal. It's going to have major consequences. We're going to have to deal with it much more in greater detail and much more seriously than we're currently doing. And the guttural warning helps in that regard to the extent anybody pays attention to it.
Well, in a surprise, you found climate instability may not be totally bad. Tyrants may have a harder time, or maybe people will develop a larger sense of sharing. Talk to us about that.
I think there is a lot of constructive opportunity here, actually. There are definitely things that can be done. We could bring, if you will, the global warming impulse under control in, say, half a century by an organized transformation of energy generation globally. That'll ultimately have to be done anyway if we make a big deal of it. And by the way, that's a very productive way of diverting investment assets that I think are finding some difficulty being productive. It just requires thinking on a global scale and diverting, if you will, current energy markets off onto a different track by deliberate public action. It's a matter of, if you will, organizing public policy much more decisively on a much broader scale than we're used to doing. If we did do that, many things, many security issues could be substantially benefited, if you will. So it is an opportunity for reforming or sort of putting our international relationships on a much more productive basis. And, if you will, recognizing a common interest that requires common action and requires it enough that it actually occurs. So there's a lot that is actually positive in this situation.
Well, I'm thinking, too, about people who are engulfed in a climate emergency, whether they're in Asia or in the Rockaways of New York. They may have to create an instant community of self-help. Maybe we'll see more localization and resilience developing as big weather events strike with more regularity. What are your thoughts on that?
That is certainly part of the story. When you're talking about these weather episodes such as Sandy, the resilience of the local community matters a whole lot. And the ability, if you will, to give help to local communities from remote locations is a major question. I mean, as I see we're seeing, we think that we responded to Sandy reasonably well, but the people in Brooklyn who are still without power don't think so, and they are right not to think so. So Sandy tells us that our ability, which we think is more advanced than some other places, is still not adequate to events of this magnitude. And therefore, you know, we need to get better at it at all levels, locally, nationally, and globally. And the internet, the interaction, this sort of flow of information, potentially at any rate, helps in that regard. I was told, for example, I live in Washington, D.C., there was somebody in our neighborhood who was going around collecting food and blankets and other things and driving them up to New York to the neighborhoods in question, not waiting for government relief agencies to do this, just literally doing it on an individual basis. Enough people do that, it would make a difference.
Well, that is a plot I would like to see succeed. You have been listening to Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Professor John D. Steinbruner about a report by the National Research Council for the American Intelligence Community and the government. It's titled Climate and Social Stress Implications for Security Analysis. You can find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Professor Steinbruner, thank you for sharing your time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
Now we turn to unreported news. Huge oil spills continue in Nigeria. American and European multinational companies are dodging the law and wreaking havoc with nature and local people. From the Washington studios of WPFW Pacifica Radio, EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams reports.
We're talking today with Jonathan Kaufman. He is a staff attorney with Earth Rights International. He leads ERI's work on transparency and U.S. policy advocacy on international accountability mechanisms. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, Jonathan.
Thanks so much.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit today about what's happening with Nigeria. There's a big case that involves a giant oil company that is before an international court. But before we get into that, could you give a little bit of background about the extent and the duration of the oil operations in Nigeria and the companies involved? And what is the actual case that's being brought forward?
Well, oil has been extracted in the Niger Delta, in particular in Nigeria. So that's a large kind of swampy area in the southeast part of Nigeria since the 1950s, I think. And I think Shell has basically been in there from the beginning. I think that they've been the largest participant and they've been there from the beginning. By this time, you've got most of the major oil companies extracting oil in the Niger Delta. So that includes Chevron and Exxon, also Eni Agip, which is the big Italian company, Total, the French oil company as well. So most of the major oil companies in the world are pumping oil either in the creeks that are part of the swampland of the Niger Delta or offshore on platforms.
And I assume they've all been model citizens, that they have been, you know, paragons and examples of environmental responsibility during these years.
Well, I wish I could say that was the case. The Niger Delta is often cited as one of the world's ecological disasters. You've had tremendous, tremendous oil spills there that generally go uncleaned for decades. And this kind of came to light, and you started seeing it in headlines in, say, The Times and The Washington Post during the big BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And people suddenly started to remember that there are a lot of places around the world that have been dealing with this kind of thing for decades. The comparison is really striking. You know, BP has a disastrous spill in the Gulf of Mexico, one of the largest in history. And now, you know, they immediately agreed to put aside billions and billions of dollars for reparations to fishermen and to rehabilitate the ecosystem. The U.S. government is prosecuting them again to the tune of billions of dollars. Meanwhile, in the Niger Delta, you've had millions and millions of gallons of oil spilled over the course of 50, 60 years, and the locals have to fight tooth and nail to get anyone even to recognize what's happened.
I had been looking at the summary of a report last year from the UN Environmental Program that talked about a three-year investigation in which it was found that there was heavy contamination in Nigeria of land and underground water. Sometimes more than 40 years after it had been spilled, community drinking water with dangerous concentrations of benzenes and other pollutants, soil contaminated so farming can't take place. And what I find most damning was that there was evidence that most of the spill sites that the firms had claimed to have cleaned up are still highly contaminated. And so they have failed even to meet their own standards for cleanup. And also of Nigeria's own standards, which brings up the situation in which the Nigerian government and the oil companies are really together, working together in ways that do not benefit the citizens of the country. Could you talk about their collaboration between the Nigerian forces and the government and Shell?
Sure. First of all, I do want to say that the Niger Delta is a very complicated area. And I don't want to minimize how difficult it is to operate and to have pipelines there. There are armed militants, there are criminal gangs, there's a lot of siphoning off of oil supplies. But whenever there's an oil spill, the first thing that the oil companies say is, it was sabotage. The communities did it. You know, they blew up the pipeline. They put an illegal tap into the pipe and it, you know, exploded and it created a rupture or whatever it is. And that is immediately the first thing that they say.
But you do concede that that does happen.
It absolutely happens. But it's also really important to point out that the Nigerian government doesn't have any independent capacity to investigate what causes these spills. The only information that they have comes from the oil companies themselves. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be surprising that very often in Nigerian official accounts, you see that it will say the overwhelming majority of oil spills are caused by sabotage and by communities, because it's the oil companies that are self-reporting. But whenever civil society groups go to check out the pipes, to check out the wellheads, the infrastructure, what they find is rusting, decaying pipes that should have been replaced years, if not decades ago, and plenty of evidence that it's in fact poor maintenance and poor upkeep, at least as much, if not more, than local sabotage. But as far as the way that the Nigerian government works with the oil companies, again, it's complicated. The Nigerian government depends very, very much on oil extraction for its revenue. I've seen statistics that say that Nigeria's foreign revenue that it receives, 90% or more depends on oil at this point. And what this does is it actually creates a break in accountability between the Nigerian government and the people. Because the Nigerian government gets tons of money to do what it needs to do, what it wants to do, to line the pockets of corrupt officials. completely regardless of what it gives its own people. It doesn't have to rely on its people for taxation. It doesn't have to get the approval of people because their flow of money comes from foreign oil companies. And they can use that money to buy off opposition, to give around election time, to kind of give gifts to people to basically get short-term gain. There is a tremendous democratic problem in Nigeria that comes from the flow of oil money. I think maybe what you were referring to when you're asking me about the collaboration of security forces and oil companies, this has been a recurring problem. And it may be something that we see a little bit less of in recent years than we did 10, 15 years ago. But again, it's not gone. And what we saw in a couple of cases, including a case that we were involved in the federal courts here in the United States, was that Shell had a very symbiotic relationship with the police forces and the military forces during the military government of the 1990s. And essentially, our clients, the people that we represented, alleged that the two worked together to brutally repress opposition to the oil operations, which were causing such environmental damage and not bringing any benefits back to the communities.
Mm-hmm. It does seem as if human rights violations and environmental degradation go hand in hand when there's oil companies involved. But you had mentioned accountability, and in the case of the oil companies that are in Nigeria and elsewhere, they are nominally part of a particular country. You know, you mentioned an Italian oil company, BP is associated with Britain, and so forth. But these are multinational companies, and what kind of jurisdiction applies in these cases where these companies can cause such damage? Who assesses what the damage is, and how can this be carried out?
Well, there are a few possibilities. Always, you have the potential of using the Nigerian courts. I'm not saying it's a great option, but it exists. And I've actually seen judgments from Nigerian courts finding that a company should be responsible for damage. One of the environmental abuses that we see most commonly, particularly from the oil companies that operate on land in the creeks in the Niger Delta, is gas flaring. This is a practice where when you extract oil from the ground, natural gas that is found in the same underground reservoirs bubbles out. The best practice, which is practiced almost everywhere in the world except for Nigeria and, ironically, North Dakota, is to capture that gas and use it for energy, because obviously natural gas is valuable and it can be used for energy. That does require some infrastructure, and it requires that oil companies would be willing to actually invest in the country, not like Nigeria, that they've been operating in for the last 50 years. You don't have the infrastructure to capture this gas and to export it. You can reinject it back in the ground. And that is actually an environmentally responsible way of taking care of this gas. And it goes back under the ground, and it actually helps the oil companies because it helps to maintain the pressure from the underground reservoir so the oil can keep on coming out quickly. But what the oil companies do in Nigeria, by and large, is they burn it as it comes out of the ground. You have to understand that these flames are right in the middle of villages and communities. They're gigantic roaring flames that go 24 hours a day, spewing benzene and other toxins into the air. People believe that it causes elevated rates of lung problems, potentially cancer, skin problems. It poisons the water and the soil, and it goes day and night. And there was a lawsuit in Nigeria against Shell's Nigerian subsidiary in 2004, 2005. And you actually had a court coming out and saying that flaring gas was actually unconstitutional. It was a violation of the right to life because of the human impact that it had. The companies ignored it. They completely ignored the judgment. They continued to flare. The Nigerian government argued about it, talked about it, in the end gave Shell a deadline to stop flaring, and then kept on extending the deadline, extending the deadline, extending the deadline. So it's been completely ignored. So Nigerian courts, technically, you could do something there. But the truth is that there's a lot of corruption, and even if you manage to get a positive outcome, often nothing comes of it. The case that you were talking about in the Netherlands, this is also a case against Shell. A benefit that you have about companies that come from Europe is that if your company is based in a European Union country, say the Netherlands, you can be sued in the Netherlands for something that you did anywhere in the world. And that's a rule across the European Union. This was a tremendous oil spill that took place maybe 10 years back, but really a really devastating oil spill. And the plaintiffs had very good evidence that this was not sabotage. This was caused by negligence, a failure to maintain the pipes.
These were farmers.
These were farmers,
their land had been completely damaged and unusable, so they couldn't earn a living.
So when you have oil spills offshore, often it's a bit more subtle what kind of effects it has. You know, it will affect the fish population, and a lot of the people along the coast of Nigeria are fishermen. There's a tremendous Exxon oil spill a few years back where it wasn't detected for a little while, and oil was gushing out into a very rich fishery, and it killed off a lot of the fish. Exxon then used dispersants that would not be allowed in the United States that continued to poison the fisheries, and so the people along that part of shoreline are just completely out of luck. But when you have an oil spill in a wetland area where farmland is scarce and very precious, where particular trees have particular economic value, where people rely on the creeks to catch fish, the damage can be incalculable. I mean, you are talking about completely making it impossible for communities to continue living where they live because all of their means of survival are just wiped out. So this case, this Bodo case, that is a Shell case, the communities and the local organization that helps them out, a really wonderful environmental organization called Environmental Rights Action, they found lawyers in the Netherlands to sue Shell in their home in The Hague. It's not actually an international court. It's a local court in The Hague that has the power and the competence to hold Shell responsible for things that it did anywhere in the world. And Shell's first response was, it wasn't us. It was our subsidiary in Nigeria. Our subsidiary is a completely separate entity, and we can't be held responsible for what our subsidiary did. The lawyers were actually, in that case, able to convince the court to drag the subsidiary into court as well. So the two, both Shell and its subsidiary, would have to defend themselves together. And that case went to trial. They had their final hearing a few weeks ago, maybe about a month ago. A verdict is expected, I think, by the end of the year or early next year.
Now, will the outcome be compensation to these individual farmers? Will it be to the country of Nigeria? How will the people have redress to this, the damage to their lands and hopefully any other similar kinds of actions that happen in the country?
In this case, as far as I know, it is actually damage paid to the farmers whose land was destroyed. Mm-hmm. This is a lawsuit like any other, where one person says, you damaged me or my property, and you have to pay for it. In itself, it's not a recipe for systemic change. But it does say to oil companies, you can't necessarily get away with it. Most communities aren't going to have the evidence and the wherewithal and the connections in other countries to get this kind of justice. But it does say that there's a possibility that the things that you do in Nigeria, where you think no one's watching, and therefore you think they have no cost, they do have a cost. And this sets a precedent. It's very exciting. It's the first case that I know of where a European company is potentially being held responsible in Europe for causing oil spills in Nigeria or other countries.
So this leads me to ask you about the intriguingly titled Alien Tort Statute that's been getting a bit of a buzz lately. It's a statute. Well, you explain what it is. All I know is that it's pretty ancient, 1789.
Yeah.
But it's being applied in an interesting way to human rights violations.
That's right. And I should say that before, as we get into it, you'll see the Alien Tort Statute is great, and it is a very important tool that we have for human rights protection. But it's not necessarily something that we can use for things like oil spills. So the Alien Tort Statute was passed, as you said, in 1789 or 1790, one of the first laws in the New American Republic when we were setting up our courts. You have to understand the background for this is that America was like the original rogue nation. We were Somalia in 1789. The rest of the world was terrified of us, and they had no idea what we were going to do, how we were going to affect the world order. Of course, we weren't Somalia, and the founding fathers were concerned about how the rest of the world would see us and our willingness to act responsibly. And so something that they wrote into the original setup of our courts was to say that our federal courts would be able to hear cases involving violations of international law if the plaintiff were a foreigner. In other words, if someone comes to our shores and is looking for protection and looking for some kind of justice for a violation of international law, then we're not going to deny it to them. At the time, the forms of international law that you could really have this kind of justice for were very limited. They were things like crimes against ambassadors. They were things like violations of laws of neutrality. And the one that's kind of gotten the most publicity lately is piracy, because piracy was kind of the scourge of the world at that time. And that was the original point.
But this mechanism is under scrutiny right now, I think, to the detriment of many valid human rights cases. It's before the Supreme Court, or it's already been heard?
Yeah, this law evolved in the last 30 years, and people said, you know, international law is not just about piracy and diplomacy anymore. It also includes basic human rights protections like the right not to be tortured and the protection against genocide and crimes against humanity. And they convinced the U.S. courts, including the Supreme Court, that this law could be expanded and could now be used against the modern-day pirate, who's the torturer, the genocidaire, the war criminal. And so it was used successfully to against, for example, Latin American generals from brutal regimes who had retired to Miami or New York. And so lawsuits were filed against them for terrible things that they'd done back home. An innovation in the 90s was people said, well, you know, this could also be used against companies. Companies do terrible things as well. They are complicit in human rights abuses like torture and crimes against humanity. So if you can use it against human beings, you should be able to use it against companies. And that is what opened the can of worms that ended us up in the Supreme Court. A case against Shell coming out of Nigeria for more or less what I was describing to you before, a situation in which environmental activists from the Ogoni tribe were arrested. They were put through a show trial and executed, and the Nigerian military government brutally suppressed their people and committed attacks and burned their villages and killed people.
This would be in 1993.
Yeah.
Ken Sarawiwa.
Exactly. This is the Ken Sarawiwa story. Ken Sarawiwa, the Nigerian environmental organizer who brought his people together to face down Shell and then ended up being executed for his troubles. This case comes out of those facts. And Shell has been, there were two cases, one of which Earth Rights, my organization, was involved in. And that case settled in 2009. Shell paid $15 million to settle a case involving 9 or 10 plaintiffs. But other plaintiffs continued their case. And eventually, Shell won a ruling from a federal appellate court saying that companies cannot be even held responsible for violations of international law. This alien tort statute, even though you can use it for torture and genocide, if it's a company that's a defendant, it doesn't count.
Companies are people, my friend.
So that was the ruling. It shocked many, many people because no one had said this before. No other court had come to this conclusion. And their legal reasoning was very, very suspect. It was really a shock. The case was appealed to the Supreme Court. And in late February, I think, they got their first hearing in front of the Supreme Court. And it's a little bit hard to interpret what happened. It turned out that the court didn't want to focus on whether corporations could be liable at all. I think it was a little embarrassing for them to even be talking about it, especially after a case like Citizens United, which said, you know, that essentially corporations can't be treated differently than human beings when it comes to campaign finance. To say that corporations have all the First Amendment rights of persons, of human beings, but they can't be held responsible for committing the most unspeakable acts in the world probably seemed like it was not a place that the Supreme Court wanted to go. So instead, they picked on a different part of the case, which is the fact that it took place in Nigeria and that it was a dispute between Nigerians and a Dutch company. And they said, what is this even doing in American courts? Why would we even have any interest in this case at all? Maybe the Alien Tort Statute shouldn't apply when the case arose in another country. And then they asked for a whole new set of arguments. And those arguments were presented at the beginning of October. So the truth is no one exactly knows where the Supreme Court is going to go with this. It's pretty clear that the Founding Fathers, when they wrote this into our law, they were looking at the world. They said violations of international law. Foreigners are coming to our shores, and we want to make sure that justice is served. And so it's clear to us who are on the human rights side that this law certainly was intended to apply to things that happened in other countries. It doesn't matter if it happened between a Nigerian and a Dutch person. These are universally understood norms and standards of human rights. There's no barrier. As long as the court actually has the ability to exercise their power over them, in other words, if they're present in the United States or for companies, if you're a foreign company and you do business here, courts can properly hear cases against you, then there's no basic barrier. But it did seem quite likely, based on the questions that were asked during the hearings, that the Supreme Court is interested in narrowing the situations in which the Alien Tort Statute applies. And the truth is, even if they make this decision based on something a little more technical, like whether it applies abroad, it really is about companies versus human beings. If they rule that this does not apply to acts that were committed abroad, or if they rule that it doesn't apply to foreigners, the prime beneficiaries are going to be the companies who have come under increasing scrutiny in the U.S. courts for their relationships with brutal military governments.
So what I think I hear you saying is we still do not have an overarching international mechanism for redress of environmental damages to countries, to regions, and to communities.
That's true. You know, it's certainly there's no international tribunal. A lot of people often will ask, you know, what about the International Criminal Court in The Hague, or what about some UN body? There's nothing like that for, first of all, there's nothing like that for cases against companies. The International Criminal Court is, first of all, it only involves things like genocide and war crimes, and only human beings can be held responsible there. And also, it's very, very difficult procedurally to get a case to the International Criminal Court. There's no international tribunal that involves claims of damage at all. There's no such thing, at least between, maybe between governments, but not between private parties. But what you do see is that there are a lot of ways to do it. And this case in The Hague, I think, is really important for that reason. Because even though it's not an international court, it's a court that has been given the power to look at what happens in other countries and hold a home company responsible for what they did in another country, even though it's environmental damage.
Well, I want to thank you, Jonathan Kaufman from Earth Rights International, for talking to us today about the situation with human rights and environmental rights involving oil companies. Would you like to say more about your organization and give contact information?
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, Earth Rights International, the organization that I'm an attorney with, we get involved when corporations have relations with governments that torture and kill. We get involved when companies cause tremendous pollution that has health effects and devastates indigenous communities in places like Peru and India and Nigeria. Our organization, we represent people in legal cases. We help raise their voices so that they can be heard. We help them advocate with governments. We try and change policies. And our goal is to change the power dynamic a little bit so that the people who are marginalized and poor and just kind of are often bystanders when companies come and extract wealth from their territory are actually getting benefits and not just the downside.
Well, thank you again. I remind our listeners that even though BP has been fined $4.5 billion, fined for the damages that they did in the Gulf Coast here in North America and might be facing trial, the people of Nigeria have been suffering from even worse damages for 40 years. This is Jerry Williams for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Last summer, Germany, that industrial power of Europe, had enough renewable energy to sustain their entire grid. Daphne Washam from the Institute of Policy Studies was in Berlin to find out how they did it.
And if you just want to say your name and your title.
My name is Hans Verholm. I'm a climate strategy advisor based in Berlin, Germany.
Okay, and we are sitting by the banks of the, what's the name of this river?
The River Spree, which cuts through the heart of Berlin. And we're looking at the new office buildings of the German parliament.
And we're about to head into some meetings in Parliament, but I thought I'd sit down and speak with Hans about the state of the German renewable energy revolution. They have a plan to get off of nuclear power entirely by 2021 and to phase in clean renewable energy. So how do you feel that revolution is going so far?
It's in a way going really well. If you take into account that this summer we were actually able to provide all electricity needs with renewable energy. At the same time, there are some very fundamental challenges to the energy system as a whole, which make me worried that Germany is going to continue to be dependent on fossil fuels, mostly from natural gas, that actually the existing powers, the energy companies, those that control the grid, are actually putting on the brakes, trying to retain as much control as possible, and in the process make it more difficult for renewables to be scaled up. And in particular, decentralized renewable solutions are very challenging to implement in Germany.
And tell us why it is that decentralized renewables are an important priority for you.
When you look at the electricity system in any country, but I think particularly in a highly developed country, you want to make it stable. And because at the time we do not have good storage solutions for renewables, you need them to be everywhere. You cannot really, in my view, rely on very large-scale offshore solutions, for example, to provide stable electricity, partly because simply the grid doesn't exist, but also because the old-style grid doesn't really provide the answer to the economic questions that we are facing in a country like Germany today. So what I see is a broader trend towards smart grids, decentralized provision of energy with a very high percentage of renewables provided around the corner. And not the thinking of the old industry, which is we're just going to continue to provide these very, very large-scale capacity plants, be they solar or wind or biomass. It's simply going to look like a very different energy system.
Now, in terms of the gas issue, you mentioned that you didn't feel that Germany was going to be phasing out gas, and I know that there has been some opposition to fracking, what we call fracking in the United States, hydrofracturing for natural gas in Germany, and Germany gets a lot of its gas from Russia, correct? Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the controversies around the gas industry.
Well, I think partly it's a political problem. Most Western European countries are nervous about their dependence on Gazprom and, by association, the Russian government for the provision of energy. And almost every winter there's a conflict. So contracts get renegotiated, Gazprom is demanding higher prices, and as a result, smaller East European countries sometimes actually have to go without an adequate supply of gas for a week in the middle of a snowstorm, for example. I mean, this is political blackmail that's happening, and it's making people insecure. So they don't trust a company like Gazprom to be a reliable commercial partner, and they're very uncomfortable with being dependent on them for such a large supply. I do not believe that Germany will come off gas. I mean, they are phasing out of nuclear. They are no longer building new coal capacity, and they're ultimately phasing out coal. That really leaves two big energy solutions in play. One is gas, and the other is renewables. And so the question that then follows is, so are you going to be able to provide that gas domestically? Well, we all know the consequences of fracking and the cost of fracking, and it's very unlikely that Germany is going to go full out for production of fracked gas, simply because the domestic opposition to it, the local opposition to it, will be too great. But it doesn't rule out that it will happen in some places, maybe on a sort of on a testing basis, and the big energy companies like Exxon and Chevron are lobbying hard to make that happen. But local environmentalism is very much alive in Germany, and it has stopped CCS projects, for example. I think it'll also be capable of stopping fracking.
And when you say CCS, you mean carbon capture and storage, right?
Correct, yeah.
In terms of the climate goals that Germany has set for itself and targets to reduce overall greenhouse gas emissions, renewables have played a key role in that, correct?
Yeah. Germany has a domestically set target for 2020 of minus 40% when compared to 1990 emissions. 1990 is the year that the base year of the Kyoto Protocol, and Germany is a party to the protocol. And as part of its sharing the effort within the European context, Germany has taken on this commitment. Right now, I think Germany is on track to meet that target. It's going to have to continue to invest in renewables to do so, but I don't think that even with the decision to exit nuclear, that the target will not be questioned. The real discussion is going to be what happens then in the next decade, between 2020 and 2030. And I think that's where you will see a clash of visions. Some people believe that actually, exactly in that decade, Germany can leapfrog, can move renewables to a very, very high percentage. And others are resisting, essentially, the existing fossil fuel interests, energy-intensive industries in Germany who are not comfortable making that transition.
Now, Germany is investing some figures, say, 100 billion euros in renewable energy to try to phase in renewable power and phase out nuclear power. Where is that money going?
It's going to many different places. I mean, obviously, the most visible, in some ways, the most controversial, is large-scale offshore wind. These are massive, individual turbines that generate more than a gigawatt.
Why are they so controversial?
Well, people don't want to see them when they sit on the beach. That's one way of looking at it. The other thing is that the energy that comes from these offshore fields need to be brought to the places where it's needed. Very, very large-scale solar is less visible. There are smaller solar solutions that are particularly effective in the south, but not at the scale where you can say they replace an individual power plant.
Are there a large number of green jobs being created as a result of this investment in renewables in Germany?
Yeah. One of the most powerful arguments overall, I think, when it comes to persuading conservative politicians in Germany, so the ones that are not necessarily convinced that all this renewable power is a good thing, is the jobs argument. The amount of jobs that has been created was most astonishing. And when it was compared to the jobs that were existing in, for example, the nuclear industry, people basically said, okay, this is a shut case. We see local investment, we see local job creation, high quality. You need to be well educated in order to work in that sector. And this is basically the innovation in the economy that is taking place and where the future lies. So that's been a very, very powerful argument. There's been fairly detailed economic analysis of sort of every euro invested in renewable energy and how many jobs that creates. And that basically has made the case, in addition to the fact that Germans are quite aware of the risks of global warming. Mm-hmm. Even though when you sit here in Germany, you don't immediately feel the impacts. There have been some extreme events also here in Europe. There has been flooding, there has been drought, and people in general understand that global warming will have very severe consequences for the future of humanity and are also therefore willing to act.
Talk a little bit about the feed-in tariff, because this is something that Germany has really pioneered, correct? The notion that renewables have a fixed price that returns ultimately to the people that are producing the power, correct? Explain the feed-in tariff and how it works in Germany and how successful it is.
Okay. Well, basically, the price volatility in the energy market is very difficult to deal with when you're a newcomer. So when you're building a windmill, you need to make a certain return on your investment, otherwise you go bankrupt. The prices were too volatile. The other thing was that there was no guarantee that if you produce the electricity that you could actually sell it into the market. By addressing this combined challenge, the Germans have basically opened up what was a very unlevel playing field, where there were gigantic amount of subsidies into the infrastructure for fossil fuel and barriers to entry of new businesses like renewable businesses. And this has been a long process. You cannot from one day to the next build that kind of capacity. But over the course of the past 20 years, Germany has gotten to a point now where, as this summer, it was able to actually provide for itself with wind and solar.
And the other key component in the feed-in tariff, as I understand it playing out in Germany, is that if you are to put renewable energy panels on your barn or on your house or something, then you actually... you are generating income for yourself as a result of that feed-in tariff, while also providing electricity to the grid.
Yeah, so it is a subsidy. It's not just a tax write-off, and it's particularly important because it encourages normal people to be engaged. Also for normal people to start to think about that, hey, we can provide ourselves, our communities, with the energy that we need. We don't need to rely on some far removed big company to produce dirty fuels. That hasn't hit everywhere. If you look in the different regions in Germany, I think you can say that there is a different ethic. For example, in the Southwest. In the Southwest, you really see almost in every community a large number of solar panels, also even smaller wind projects that are carried and owned by the local community or by individuals and smaller companies. Whereas if you look further north and east, you still see sort of the large-scale energy solutions.
Why is that? Why is there that big divide between the Southwest and the north and the east?
Quite frankly, this is partly cultural. It's not only cultural. I think it also has to do with the fact that the Southwest had the disposable income. So these measures came online at a point in time where economically these regions were stable. They were seeing that this was a trend, and they had both the knowledge and the capital to move. And this has turned into a first mover advantage. So, you know, you do a good thing, it attracts another good thing, and as a result, you sort of snowball the local economy. And that hasn't, unfortunately, happened in other places.
So in terms of providing for, you mentioned that this summer Germany had more renewable energy than it could actually use. How did that play out in terms of the grid, and what sort of fallout has there been with the other energy providers in Germany?
I mean, because the renewable energy has preferential access, they had to reduce producing from large-scale plants. So they had to shut down gas turbines and such. There was, on the one hand, of course, people were really excited. And sort of this is clear evidence that it can be done. And actually, it happened sooner than some had expected. But there was also the backlash. You sort of indicated that those companies that are still vested heavily in fossil fuel started using it as an argument to say, well, clearly the time for supporting renewable energy is over. You know, if anybody needs to be supported, it is us poor fossil fuel companies. Now, they didn't mention that they anyway have been receiving support for a very, very long time and benefiting royally from it, and they still do. But that was one of the backlashes that we saw. But I think overall people are simply very excited that what for a long time was considered a dangerous experiment is actually proving out to be an economic miracle and a good one at that. But I think the pressure on the sector will continue. We now see that it's increasingly difficult for local German companies to compete with renewable technologies because some of the subsidies have been removed or reduced, and the cost of renewable technology is dropping very fast globally, which also has negative consequences if you are producing in a country where production costs are high.
Now, today, would you say, 25% of Germany's energy comes from renewables? What share of overall electricity is produced by renewables?
I actually have to look it up, but I think you're right. It's about a quarter.
And by 2021, it will be what, roughly?
It could be half.
Could be half.
Yeah.
But the goal is to phase out the nuclear, which is roughly, what, about 12%, 10, 12%? So yeah. At least 35%.
Yeah. I mean, it really depends, like, of what happens to some of the legal frameworks, right? There's going to be an election next year. If the government that comes in decides very firmly that they are serious about not just saying they want what they call here an Energiewende, but actually also supporting it, then I think that shift will happen. And of course you get sort of to beyond a certain tipping point, and we're very close to that tipping point. You know, once the sector has moved so substantially, then it's like you've set a ball rolling down the hill. It'll continue to roll. And I think that's what the exciting thing is here in Germany, that we are witnessing that this ball is picking up some speed, and that unless there is a decision by the new government to cut support for the sector, which it could do in the face of very strong opposition from those vested interests. But I frankly don't think that will happen. I think that the public understands the benefits and wants those benefits, and any politician who argues differently is very quickly losing credibility.
So if you were to give advice to activists or others in the United States or Canada, what would that advice be? Learning from the German model to try to get the renewable energy revolution kick-started in those countries?
It's always difficult to replicate, right? You're in a very different socio-political environment. I mean, based on the decade that I spent in the United States, it is actually important to continue to talk about global warming as an issue. So not to say we're trying to do this only because we want to cut our dependence on foreign oil. There is an important moral basis to the decision that was taken here in Germany, which is very deeply rooted, and that is part of the success of what's happening here. It explains, for example, why this is a bipartisan issue in Germany. You see also a conservative government acting simply because it is in the best interest of Germany to act, not because some ideologue tells you that it needs to be done, right? And that's very important. The second thing is that energy security can ultimately only be obtained through more localized solutions. And that's a difficult debate in the United States, but it needs to be had. So once the public starts to appreciate that actually there are elegant solutions that provide jobs, then they will start to view renewables differently. Now, the third, and this is the most difficult task, would be to level the playing field, or, in my opinion, to slant it the other direction. You know, after decades and decades of what I consider corruption, you know, the public paying large companies to make more money for them to bring us polluting energy, that system needs to change.
From Berlin, you just heard energy expert Hans Verholm, interviewed by longtime Earthbeat radio host Daphne Washam. Three stories from a spinning planet. This has been Radio EcoShock. Find out more in our blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.